Blog Talk Radio.
You may not be paid for the job.
And some of you will be
And welcome to the Red Fox Blogger with your hosts, Tim Burton and Kel Fritzy. We hope that you are having a wonderful day today. I am having, again, a stupendous day. My days just seem to get brighter and brighter. I think it has something to do with spring. I don't know what it is, but believe me, we're having beautiful weather out there, and I can hardly wait to get out there and enjoy it further. Riding my bike or running in the park, it's just wonderful. I love spring. And I want to say hello to my co-host, Tim. Hi, Tim.
Well, good evening, young lady. And how the devil are you tonight?
Infidelity fine. How are you?
Unbelievably good as well. And I'm very pleased to hear you're having a beautiful spring day here. We're having a typical Birmingham spring day. I have to say the smog has lifted slightly and I can see more than 6 inches outside my front door. And I can find my way down the road by listening to the sounds of the birds coughing in the trees. So, yes, it's a wonderful day here in Birmingham. And there's no finer place. There's no finer place you would want to be at this time of year.
So if you're not chipping blackbirds out of the trees and sweeping them up, you're literally having to fight through smog.
Oh yeah, you know, I mean, things are really looking up here. You know, the days of chipping the blackbirds off the branches and sweeping them up, you know, that's gone for another few months at least. So yeah, it's all good. It's all gravy, as they like to say on that side of the pond.
All good, all gravy. GC
yes,
rocks. There you go. Oh, wow. But, oh, you know, chores do really have to get done, though. And I really dislike having to come back inside the house to take care of chores, but they must be done. And including taking care of a dog, a cat, a laundry, the kitchen, supper, and everything else. I'd rather be just sitting in the backyard with a very, very nice whiskey sour.
Sounds good to me. If I wasn't 5,000 miles away, I'd come over and join you. But there you go.
There you go.
Oh, dear. So what do we have tonight for our listeners, Kel?
We have quite a full plate. And we are going to discussing the Rules for Radicals and the Cloward Pivens proposal. And I've been reading this Cloward Pivens proposal, and that I don't know what to make of it, Tim. And just to give our listeners a preamble, is that the Cloward Pivens strategy is a political strategy which was outlined in 1966. By American sociologists. Okay, that got my guard up a little bit there. You know, sociology and political activists. Oh, there we go again. There go the hairs on the back of my neck going up again. This was proposed by Richard Cloward and his wife, Frances Fox Piven, and that for overloading the U.S. public welfare system in order to precipitate a crisis that would lead to a replacement of the welfare system with a national system of a guaranteed annual income and thus an end to poverty. Now, what they were proposing, Cloward and Piven, they were both professors at the Columbia University School of Social Work. The strategy was formulated in a May 1966 article in liberal magazine The Nation titled The Weight of the Poor, a strategy to end poverty. Now, Tim, bear with me here. The two stated that many Americans who were eligible for welfare were not receiving benefits and that a welfare enrollment drive would strain local budgets, precipitating a crisis at the state and local levels that would be a wake-up call for the federal government, particularly the Democratic Party. There would also be a side consequence of the strategy, according to Cloward and Piven. These would include easing the plight of the poor in the short term through their participation in the welfare system, shoring up support for the National Democratic Party, then splintered by pluralistic interests through its cultivation of poor and minority constituencies, my apologies, by implementing a national solution to poverty and relieving local government of the financially and politically onerous burden of public welfare through a national solution to poverty, quote unquote. Now, when I read this sort of thing, it all sounds very well and good, because I think that what they were gunning for was to get people off the welfare roll and get them involved in a program in which they would actually have guaranteed income. But would this be worse on our tax dollars, Tim?
Well, I mean, this is the question, isn't it? Because it's all very well saying that you're going to overload the welfare system until it creaks at the seams and eventually collapses. The problem with something like that, of course, is that it's likely to have unintended consequences. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that struck me when I first started reading about the Cloward-Piven strategy was how similar some of the proposals that were going back 50 years, remember, how similar some of those proposals were to what we're actually seeing today in the United States. In fact, the similarities on one level are uncanny, because you've got the Obama administration who seem to be doing their level best to get as many people onto some form of welfare as possible, whether it's through financial handouts or through food stamps or all sorts of all sorts of ideas and gimmicks to support people who are supposedly so badly off that they need the government in their lives in order to be able to survive. I've got a general view on welfare benefit, which is that I think that every civilized society should have the means of providing some support to those who are genuinely in need and cannot look after themselves, maybe through no fault of their own. I'm thinking about people who are genuinely disabled, people whose life circumstances suddenly and unforeseeably change and they just don't have a way to recover in the short term. A welfare system, those are just two examples, okay? I'm sure our listeners can think of plenty of other examples, but under those circumstances, I think it's right that any society that calls itself civilized should make provision for groups of people who cannot look after themselves. And of course, you know, there are plenty of people out there who would love to be able to get back to the point where they were, or would love to be able to work up to where they were, and they just need a little bit of short-term help. And there are plenty of people out there who have, through perhaps long-term disability, they've got no chance of making an effective contribution to looking after themselves by themselves. If they're lucky enough to have family, that's one thing. But if they're not, then welfare benefits are a lifeline. And I think under those circumstances, every civilized country should have a welfare system. But it needs to be very tightly regulated and controlled, because there are obviously, where you've got free money involved, there are always going to be people who are going to be looking to abuse the system. And yeah. What we're finding, especially, I'm sure it's similar in Canada, but certainly over here in the UK, what we find is that there's a lot of people on welfare benefits of one form or another who are perfectly capable of working, and who choose not to, because it's much easier to stay at home and do nothing and receive money. You know, wouldn't we all like to do that? It would be wonderful if we were all freed from the responsibility of having to work for a living, and we could all rely on the government to hand out money ad infinitum for the whole of our lives. We could pursue much more fulfilling lives. I'm sure many of us could pursue much more fulfilling lives if we didn't have to go out to work for a living. But of course, the welfare system is predicated on at least some people paying into that system through contributions from work that they do. And so you cannot have a welfare system where you've got no productive people at all. So the question is, where do you strike the balance? And I would suggest that at the moment, the balance is, in most Western democracies at least, is structured far too much in favour of people who don't really need those benefits at all. And in fact, we're making the system a lot worse in some cases by importing people who go straight onto welfare benefit and produce no net contribution to society at all. And I think that's just suicidal. But that, in a nutshell, I always use that phrase when I've talked non-stop for 5 minutes. In a nutshell, that's my view of how an ideal welfare system should be. But Cloward and Piven had quite a different view of it altogether, and that's hopefully what we're going to analyze tonight.
One thing that really disturbs me about this is that it just seems to be an extension of what happened after the Great Depression in the United States, in that it's just another enabling ideology, and that there's been a lot of criticism behind this proposal, and I'm not particularly impressed with the strategy in that Cloward and Piven, they had this article that focused on forcing the Democratic Party, which in 1966 controlled the presidency and both houses of the United States Congress, to take federal action to help the poor. They stated that full enrollment of these eligible for welfare would produce bureaucratic disruption in welfare agencies and fiscal disruptions in local and state governments that would deepen existing divisions among elements within the big city Democratic coalition, the remaining white middle class, the working class, ethnic groups, and the growing minority poor. To avoid a further weakening of this historic coalition, a national Democratic administration would be constrained to advance a federal solution to poverty that would override local welfare failures, local class, and radical conflicts, local revenue dilemmas as well. This really bothers me, in that we have these people speaking out and saying that we are going to rewrite government policy, and we are going to ensure that we're going to strong arm the government to enact a policy such as this. And they were focusing on the Democratic Party at the time, which was quite strong, and that they were in control of the House and the Senate, and that they were taking advantage of this. This is what I see with the Cloward-Piven strategy. That is a strategy.
Yeah, I can see that they perhaps had altruistic goals with what they were doing. They were talking about the elimination of poverty by redistribution of income. Well, that's been the goal of pretty much every socialist government for the past 50 years. And All right, it could be argued that when you have a capitalist system, there is a tendency for the producers of capital to hold on to as much of that capital as they can for their own benefit, and to release as little as possible for the benefit of the country as a whole. That's one argument. But the contrary argument is, if you were to force capitalists to release all of their capital for the benefit of the company of the country as a whole, what you would end up with is you wouldn't have anybody bothering to do any work at all, because the government would be taking all their money off them. And that would lead to a situation which would be just as bad at one end of the scale as it would to the other. So there has to be a happy medium, one would think, whereby you create the conditions for people to produce wealth, and then you see that at least a proportion of that wealth is shared out amongst the less fortunate of society. But of course, the danger is that once you've got that principle established, if a socialist government gets hold of that idea and implements it, the tendency is for them to give away far more money than is strictly needed by welfare claimants so that they can get extra votes out of it. And that, unfortunately, has pretty much always been the case ever since the concept of the welfare state came into being. And it's a regrettable tendency, but human nature being what it is, our parliamentary systems and our democratic systems being what they are, you have to accept that tendency is there, and you have to try and do what you can to curb the worst excesses. Right at the moment, we don't seem to be doing very much at all to curb the worst excesses of socialist governments, and that strategy, yeah. The Cloward-Piven strategy, seems to be almost tailor-made for the Obama administration in particular. Obama seems hell-bent on putting the majority of Americans onto some sort of welfare benefit, because if he can do that and get them reliant on welfare benefit, they'll be less inclined to vote for people who will take it away in the future. It's a highly immoral strategy, but I suppose Democrats would argue, well, if it means we can hang on to power, then the end justifies the means. And of course, that particular argument, the end justifies the means, is one of the things we're likely to hear again before the end of this program, because it forms a central plank of Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals, which hopefully we'll be discussing later on in the program.
You know, when I was reading this report by Cloward-Pivens, it jogged in my memory about a paper I read years ago, and this is pertaining to the New Deal, and that is what was proposed by then-President Roosevelt, and that Franklin D. Roosevelt, and that he enacted the New Deal between 1933 and 1936, and that was to create a social safety net for people, which was supposed to actually be an emergency measure to help people out of poverty. And, of course, this came on the heels of the Great Depression. That was a very noble idea. But what happened is that the social programs never left, and people still languish in social services, and they languish on welfare. And there are demographics in particular, like you mentioned, Tim, that are not getting themselves up, and they're not pulling up the bootstraps and getting off. This is a very, very poor strategy, in my opinion, because what it does is that it allows people, it gives them license to live and wallow in a sense of victimhood. And I'm a victim. I'm poor. I can't get a job. I have 7 kids. I can't do this. I can't do that. I can't. We turned into a society of I can't do this, as opposed to what our forefathers did, in which they said, I can.
Well, yeah, and this is one of the flaws, that it takes no account of the way the human mind works under these circumstances. If somebody is in a situation of genuine need, and they have for a limited time the amount of money that's necessary to stop them dying of starvation, keep a roof over their head, then well and good. But if you continue to give people money when they're past that point, then they find ways in their mind to justify the continuation of the circumstances to enable them to receive that money. So as you say, you take a person who's perfectly capable of going out to work, and all right, maybe he's had some temporary crisis in his life, and he's receiving some money from the government to help him overcome that. And what he realizes is that it's actually quite nice not having to work. He's maybe recovered from whatever the temporary crisis was. He's capable, perhaps, of going back to work, but he's getting this nice little check coming through every week or every month or however often as it is. And so his mind will find, this isn't true of everybody, okay, but there is a regrettable tendency amongst a lot of a lot of people to start thinking along the lines of, I'm getting some money for nothing here. Wouldn't it be nice if that happy state of affairs continued? You know, I've maybe got into the habit of not getting up in order to go out to work every morning. I can stay in bed and have an extra cup of tea or an extra slice of toast. And, hey, I can lie in bed till lunchtime if I want, and I'll still get paid. And if you once you start thinking like that, it's only a short step to saying, well, let's see if I can perpetuate this as long as I can so that I don't have to go back to work at all. And that is unfortunately what a significant number of people are currently doing, and it's starting to show. If it were only a tiny handful of people who thought like this, it wouldn't really matter. The welfare system is still a good system in principle, but if you start to encourage people to keep taking from the welfare system, it means, for one thing, your welfare bills are going to get much bigger. For the other thing, it means that the people have to work harder to generate the money for the unproductive people. And if you get the ridiculous situation like you have in America, where you've got virtually one half of the people on some sort of welfare and the other half are paying for it, that is a state of affairs which cannot last forever, because people just will not stand for it. There has to be a balance, and I would say a 50-50 balance of half the people working and half the people not working is not going to be a long-term happy state of affairs. But governments don't seem to be too concerned about that. I mean, Obama solves that problem by just borrowing trillions of dollars whenever he needs it. If he thinks he's running out of money, he just raises the debt ceiling, borrows a few more billion dollars, and carries on as if nothing had happened. And of course, if you have a bottomless pit of money that never needs to be repaid, then you could keep on going forever on that, and you could draw more people into your welfare benefit trap, who would then obviously vote for you the next time round because they like the idea of free money. So it's a very, very corrupting system to have if you allow it to get out of hand. And getting out of hand is exactly what has happened in America, and it's going that way in pretty much every other Western democracy. So it's
This was a very well and refined idea at the time, and this is in the, you know, this took place in the 1960s. But it led to a massive expansion of welfare rolls, and this is my problem. People became dependent on the government, and our government became larger. I think that the dependency on government is got to stop. I do not believe in big government, and I do not believe in living off the teeth of the government. But what we're also experiencing, Tim, is it's just not the indigenous population that is becoming more reliant on the welfare state. It's the immigrant that we are importing today. And when I talk about the immigrant, in particular, what comes to mind are those of Islam that are coming over from Somalia in North America in particular. And Canada, we are seeing that as well. You're seeing that in the UK. What's happening is that one man comes over with one wife, and maybe they have one or two children, and then all of a sudden the aunt is here or the sister is here, and they are all ensconced in public housing, and they are all ensconced in a very generous welfare program. They get their health taken care of. They get everything taken care of. And the next thing you know, because of ideologies like this, we are sponsoring maybe up to 30 people on our tax dollars.
We certainly get the same thing over here, of course, and it's one of the strategies that has got a lot worse ever since 1997, when the Labour government came into power under Tony Blair. And one of the first things he did was to throw open the borders of the United Kingdom to pretty much anybody who wanted to come in. And the thing is that lots of people, if they're able to find the wherewithal to make the trip from wherever they happen to live in the world to the United Kingdom, lots of people do want to come to live here, because over the past few hundred years, we have built up a society which is the one, I hesitate to use the words the envy of the world, but nevertheless, it has got a lot of things going for it that people don't have going for them in what we like to call the third world. Well, there are various problems with this. One is, of course, if they come in and they go straight on to welfare benefits, they're a net drain on the financial resources of the country. And you might think, well, if it's only a small number of people, we can accommodate that. And then if they assimilate and integrate into our societies and become productive citizens, well and good. Unfortunately, there are no checks on exactly who we have coming into our country. And what we have found, some almost 15 plus years on, is that people who have come into our country are not net productive citizens. In fact, in the case of Islam and immigration from Muslim countries, the net result is that they are a vast drain onto our economy, and they also bring with them baggage from their countries in the form of Islamic ideology, which teaches them that the kuffar society is to be despised, individual kuffar non-Muslims are to be despised, and that Muslims are the best of people. That's, I think, Quran chapter 3, verse 110, for those of us who might want to know. And the net consequences are they bring with them social problems because of that, and we then find that they're much more likely to be flouting the kuffar laws, which is why they're overrepresented in our criminal justice system and in our prisons, and all sorts of other social ills because they don't assimilate and integrate. They form ghettos. These are self-segregating people. We didn't form ghettos. Certainly when they came over in 1997 onwards, we did not reject them. We did not ask them to self-segregate and to form ghettos. They decided that we were not good enough to live side by side with, and so the ghettos that they formed, they made it very unpleasant for anybody who was non-Muslim to live there, and they very quickly became 100% Muslim ghettos. Now, I have to say, I'm not talking about every single Muslim when I say this, but what I am saying is that if you import enough of these people into a country without some careful control, you're going to end up with some very undesirable social consequences as a result. And that's just my observation on Islamic immigration, seeing as how you brought it up. But when you're going back to Cloud Pivens, of course, and if your object is to completely wreck the welfare system by making it so difficult for the productive people in the country to supply enough money to keep everything running like clockwork, then sooner or later you are going to have social consequences. But I think the social consequences that we're getting are not what Cloward and Pivens envisaged. And that's the problem with wonderful social experiments like this, that the liberals, it tends to be universally liberals that dream up these ridiculous ideas. One of the consequences, or rather one of the things that happen, is a series of unintended consequences that end up producing results which are for nobody's benefit at all. They're in nobody's interest at all. It's certainly not in our interest as a country in the UK, and I'm sure this is true in Canada. It's not in our interest to have a rapidly growing class of people who do not share our values, who do not want to assimilate, who are a net drain on the welfare benefits that our country has so generously provided, and who have a stated goal of overthrowing the Kufar government, whenever that's a practical proposition, and replacing it with Islamic Sharia law. Now, that's a stated goal of Islam. And nothing that liberals can say about how we're racist and bigoted and Islamophobic will change that fact. So that is one of the unintended consequences, perhaps, of the mass immigration, which changed the complete face of our welfare benefit system and the complete face of our countries.
Sorry, I muted myself because I was I had a pop-up. I was looking for something. But, yeah, that is the ramifications that we're dealing with right now, in that we never envisioned that this would be what we would be facing today. Or I have been looking at various lengths regarding this proposal, and it one that comes to mind is from Glenn Beck, and he referred to the Cloward-Piven strategy. He talked about it quite often on his then Fox News television show, which was Glenn Beck, and he talked about it coming back and biting us because it would help inspire President Barack Hussein Obama's economic policy. Glenn Beck, for example, he said that you've got total destruction of wealth coming. It's the final phase of the Cloward-Piven strategy, which is the collapse of the system, because we are turning into a state of enablers. And he's right about that. Richard Kim, he wrote in 2010 in The Nation. He says, such assertions is a reactionary paranoid fantasy, but says the left's gut reaction upon hearing it, to laugh it off as Scooby-Doo comic mystery, does nothing but blunt its appeal or limits its impact. The Nation later stated that Beck blames the Cloward-Piven strategy for the financial crisis of 2008, healthcare reform, Obama's election, and massive voter fraud, and has resulted in the posting of much violent and threatening rhetoric by users on various websites, including death threats against Ms. Piven herself. For her part, Piven vigorously continues to defend the original idea, calling its conservative interpretation lunatic. Now, this is... See what happens when you let a bunch of sociologists out of the institute. See what happens.
Quite. I mean, I'm firmly of the opinion that people on the left of the political spectrum should never be allowed anywhere near the levers of power in government, because they have their heads completely full of unworkable ideas that sound great on paper but never work in practice, because human nature and the law of unintended consequences is always going to get the uppermost hand. It's a fine idea having let's collapse the system of welfare that we currently have, and that will force the government to implement a federal solution to poverty. But it doesn't do that at all. What it results in is everybody being worse off in so many different respects, because the quality of life for everybody is lowered. If you put a lot of people on welfare, what happens is that they lose a lot of the integrity that they would have had if they'd been forced to stand on their own two feet, and you've turned them into net recipients of welfare and given them a mindset which mitigates them being productive citizens. Now, I'm not advocating wage slavery by any means, but I think it's everybody's right to be a productive citizen, because it brings with it so many associated benefits. There's obviously the benefit of being part of the wealth creating society in whatever form you might do that if you have a job. There is the benefit of having the taxes that are then given to the government, and the government would hope, yeah, one would hope, uses it for worthy causes. And there is also the indefinable quality of the satisfaction you get of doing something well that inspires you onto greater things. Now, that's something that's perhaps more difficult to achieve if you know that you're a net recipient of government money when you could be working and being a productive citizen. There is going to be something eating away at the back of your mind there, as one part of your mind works frantically to try and justify the fact that you're getting money for nothing, and the other part of your mind is saying, well, I feel quite guilty about this, and that's going to eat away at least it will eat away at people with a conscience. It may not eat away at people who think that they are entitled to welfare benefits. And again, when we were talking about Muslim immigration, part of the problem we have there is that Islamic ideology incorporates the concept of jizya, the payment that every non-Muslim must pay to Muslims in a Muslim-run society, so that Muslims can live on the fat of the land, as it were, and do exactly as they want, while other people pay for it. Well, it's a completely immoral system, and but Muslims bring that baggage with them when they come over here, and they persist following the Islamic ideology. And we we've bought into the fiction that Islam is somehow a benign and tolerant religion of peace, fully compatible with Western civilization, as I'm sure you've heard me say before. And it's a complete fiction. It's an utter lie. It's not compatible in the slightest. And if it were implemented, we would all become, that is to say, us non-Muslims, we would all become either third-class citizens in our own country, or we would have to convert to Islam if we wanted not to have to live under these intolerable circumstances, or Muslims would fight us until either we won or they won. And we're rapidly approaching the point now where if something is not done, we're actually going to have to fight to retain what our ancestors have built up and handed down to us over the centuries. We're going to have to fight now, and that might mean blood on the streets. And I wish I didn't have to say that. I would like to see a peaceful solution whereby we can all get along together, but Islam simply will not allow it. But that's, as I say, that's specific to do with Muslim immigration, and it's just another unintended consequence of what we were talking about. And that's why you should never, ever trust liberals anywhere near the seats of the levers of power in government, because they will screw it up. Now, I'm sure what they would say is that if you have a right-wing government in power, that has the potential for evil in other ways. Well, perhaps so, but that's what a democratic system is for—to try and keep everything with a series of checks and balances, so that you don't end up with the pendulum tilting too far one way or the other. But when you get liberals in the equation, they remove all the checks and balances, swing the pendulum so far in their direction that it actually has the unintended consequence of making everybody much worse off than before they started. But that's just my humble opinion.
Well, you know, it's a very, very, very valid opinion. There was a time our forefathers, they're not even our forefathers, they're our grandfathers, and they're our fathers and mothers, in which that we were brought up in an era that we worked hard for everything we obtained, and we were ashamed to live off the Cloward Piven ideology. Today, though, it is so acceptable, and getting to the current caliber of immigration that we're getting, and, of course, that would include Muslims, But we have homegrown rabble rousers, whether it be in Canada, the United States, Australia, or the UK. And when I hear people like Ajin Chowdhury talk about the Jihad Seekers Allowance, and I want to thank Paul Alexander in the chat room for this link. You need to get support. He calls it the Jihad Seekers Allowance. Oh, my God, is this 929 all over again, Tim? Like, this guy is talking about, you know, the rest of the year they're busy with jihad or holy war and things like that. People will say, ah, but you're not working. But the normal situation is for you to take money from the coffer or non-believer. And so we take our Jihad Seekers Allowance, and that is, it shocks me that we would even tolerate this. And Ajin Chowdhury, he was born and raised in the UK, and he is advocating this. Not only is he a welfare bum, he is advocating all Muslims, for example, to collect their jihad allowance. Now, ladies and gentlemen, Ajin Chowdhury is a lawyer by trade. And by the way, your tax dollars paid for his tuition. And he is living on the welfare state, and he is encouraging this. But it is global. We see this everywhere. We have situations in Toronto, Ontario, Canada, where they come over and they demand that they are entitled to their they're entitled to their entitlements, and it just makes me really sick. So when we have to report stories like this, this is just, you know, another example of why we have to oppose such ideologies as that of Cloward Pivens, right, Tim?
Yes, indeed. It's just another case of abuse with Ajin Chowdhury. I'm always in two minds about Ajin Chowdhury, I have to say, because on the one hand, yeah, he is notorious for spreading all sorts of sedition. I would say would
sedition.
Be
that's exactly what he's
good,
doing.
A good word. He does it, of course, because of his legal training. He does it in such a way that he stands just on the right side of British law, which infuriates the hell out of everybody. And even when people quite rightly complain about it and organise demonstrations or counter-demonstrations, like we saw the other day outside Regent's Park Mosque in London. There he was on a Friday lunchtime, every Muslim's favourite time of the week, just after Jummah prayer outside Regent's Park Mosque, with his band of merry men advocating... he was organising a demonstration to fight against what he was terming the British Crusade in Iraq and Afghanistan, I suppose. People from the patriotic groups such as Britain First and the EDL got to hear about this, and they organized a counter-demonstration. And, of course, the police turned out in force to protect Ajin Chowdhury and his band of merry men against these terrible, terrible patriots, these bigoted, racist, Islamophobic patriots who had turned up to protest another one of Ajin Chowdhury's stunts. So Ajin is busy causing all this mayhem, and he's living on what is reportedly £25,000 a year of British taxpayers' welfare money, which it's about $40,000, I think, in US dollar terms. And he's doing all this and thumbing his nose at everybody. He's getting police protection if there's any threats against him. And then you get the ridiculous scenario where people like Paul Weston of Liberty GB are arrested and charged with racially aggravated crimes just for making a speech on the steps of Winchester Guildhall, which was something that was reported last weekend. So you've got a completely a two-tier system whereby Muslim Muslims such as Anjem Chowdhury are favoured and protected disproportionately, and patriots like the EDL, like Britain First, like Liberty GB and Paul Weston are vilified and pilloried, not to say arrested and charged with racially aggravated crime. And of course, racially aggravated crime is something I know a little about, having been on the sharp end of the Crown Prosecution Service in recent weeks. I know a little bit about that. But yeah, it's a two-tier system, so everybody
you just have a passing knowledge of it, right there, Tim?
Passing knowledge. Well, yeah, I mean, the one thing I would like to just say is that a quotation from John F. Kennedy comes to mind at this point. What we're trying to do is to agitate for peaceful revolution, in a way, because this state of affairs cannot go on forever. And ideally, I'm sure all people of goodwill would like that situation to change without blood on the streets. But if the authorities continue to go down this route and they prevent peaceful revolution by silencing the voices of those people who dare to stand up and complain about what's happening. John F. Kennedy memorably said that if peaceful revolution is prevented, then violent revolution will be inevitable. And I'm afraid that is what we're going to see, because at the moment we are having our free speech taken away while all these injustices are being perpetrated and Muslims are running riot, causing mayhem and chaos at every opportunity, undermining our social institutions and plotting the overthrow of our democratic systems. Now, that cannot go on forever. Something has to give. But anyway, I digress. I'll turn the mic back to you, Kel.
What really upsets me about this proposal is that, they're turning into it's turning into a movement. And when you get these left-wing radicals and you lead them to their own devices and they come out with these papers and that they propose them and it becomes a policy within the government, this is frightening. This paper came out during the 1960s and it still has traction, Tim. It still has traction, and that it is almost like a policy maker within our current administrations, and whether that be within the United States, of course it is, you know, Obama, mm-hmm. hello Obama, mm-hmm. In the UK, hello David Cameron, Canada, not hello Stephen Harper, because he's not having any of this. But there are so many countries out there. Australia has a very good prime minister right now in that he's not buying into this. But the Western society is, and that it's scary to me that this could be incorporated as just general policy. We don't owe you a living, okay? You know what? You were born, and you have a choice. You can get up out of bed in the morning and put on your boots and go to work. I am not paying for you to stay in bed, like Tim says, until noon and have that extra cup of tea. I'm not doing it. So this Cloward Piven strategy is, in my books, thumbs down, Tim. Thumbs down.
Yeah, I think we can both agree on that, Kel, definitely. But you're absolutely right. The ideas behind it have been taken on board by the liberal left, and we are starting to see gross distortions in our democratic way of doing things, which is going to lead to consequences that are going to be bad for everybody. But I think what we've done this evening is to provide quite a good overview of the Cloward Piven strategy, and I was just wondering if there was nobody who wanted to call in and ask a few questions about it, whether we might have a trivia question this week, Kel.
Oh, absolutely. And, hey, it's funny that you bring that up, Tim, because we do. And I'm going to put the phone number in the chat room for everybody. And also to remind people that you can Skype in. And believe me, The guest call-in number is 347-237-4318, and we do have a trivia question. We're going to give you a little bit of time to think about it because we are at the top of the hour at this point, and we're going to take a little bit of a break. But, Tim, I want you to set this up. There is a situation going on in the UK. It's called the Trojan Horse Investigation. Tim and myself, we want to know, what is the name of the school at the center of the Trojan Horse Investigation? And yes, we're making these questions harder because we are down to closing out our contest. This is our second last week, and that we'll be doing it. So the trivia question for today is, what is the name of the school at the center of the Trojan Horse Investigation? Now, you don't have to call in if you don't want to. We understand that some people are shy, and that's okay. What you can do, if you're in the chat room, you can just send me a private message and answer it there. I am RFB Radio Wow, the co-host. You can see my little English rose there. And so do it that way if you like. And what we're going to do, though, we're going to let you think about that. And Googling is allowed. What is the name? Oh, go ahead, Tim.
Well, yeah, and I was going to say that if anybody is wondering about the importance of this trivia question, of course, the reason we're down to our last 2 weeks is we've only got a limited number of these fantastic prizes left on offer for the right answers to the trivia question. And the fantastic prize this week, as it has been in several previous weeks, is a coffee mug emblazoned with the face of old Fizzy Bollocks and the title on the top is Mendacious Grievance Mongering Taqiya Artist, lying about Islamophobia since 2012. And these mugs are going to be highly sought after, ladies and gentlemen. In years to come, people will be gauging your wealth on whether you have one of these mugs in your portfolio. They won't be looking on your walls to see if you've got an old master by Renoir, Manet or Van Gogh. They will be looking to see if you've got a mendacious grievance-mongering Taqiya artist mug, because they're going to be worth a fortune, ladies and gentlemen. So if you've got the answer to the trivia question, do phone in if you fancy a chat with myself or Kel. If you don't feel like phoning in, then you can drop Kel a private message on the chat room, as she suggested. And the first person to contact us with the correct answer wins a mendacious grievance mongering Taqiya artist mug. So there you go. And back to you, Kel.
And ladies and gentlemen, please scroll up and look at the slides up at the show notes, and you will see that wonderful, wonderful limited edition mug. And once again, the question is, what is the name of the school at the center of the Trojan Horse Investigation? And if you can guess that, the mug is in the mail, and it's on your way. We want to thank a whole lot of people, though, that have entered our contest, and our winners include people like A12 Iggy Mom, Eric Kyle, Dave Milner, Bigfoot, Eric Miller. We have had quite a success with this, but you better hurry up because we're down to our last two mugs. And if you don't get in here and answer that question, what can I say, Tim? They're going to lose us.
That's right. You snooze, you lose. So get on the phone or get into the chat room and send Kel a private message. And if you get the right answer, that mug will be yours.
Absolutely. And on that note, we are taking our break. We are going to see everybody back here in 4.5 minutes. Here we go, folks. And where's my cursor? Tim, what's my name? Okay, here we are. I found it. Okay,
good.
And if I had the time to solve the mystery of your crime, though I would. if I had to shape the form of your mechanical design, so I could. Well, I've been up and down the lane too. Memory of your name is stored, it's taken from the stone. Putting in the lake, I messed up my heart now. Nothing more than bones to break. But I sit, I do believe on the end of the road you weave. You may hide, you may fall, you could spend your lifetime on the pole. I don't mind. If I had the hand to take blood out of the sound, make it dry. I won't ask why. I've been in and out of windows, just trying to find a doorway. I've opened up the Bible and waiting for my shoe, but I have messed up my heart now. Nothing more than time to do. But I did.
We want to congratulate Doc in the chat room for answering our trivia question. Indeed, it was. The question was, of course, what is the name of the school at the center of the Trojan Horse investigation? And Doc guessed correctly, Parkview School. So Doc, your mug is on the way. And believe me, you would cherish this forever. And I got to say to Tim, when you pour your coffee or tea in it, you're going to make Pius Nicole really hot. But congratulations, Doc. Thank you so very much for participating in our contest. And Tim, there you go. Oh, shoot. Tim forgot to unmute himself. Tim, you forgot to unmute yourself.
Have I? Oh, dear. No, I'm definitely, I definitely should be here. Can you not hear me?
I can hear you now. I unmuted you.
Oh, you did. Oh, thanks a bunch, Kel. That's just what I wanted. That's just what I want, is a co-host who mutes my microphone at all the right times.
But you heard that we have a winner, and that is Doc from the chat room. And I have his mailing details, and he is going to be the proud owner of the Mendacious Grievous Mongering Takiya Artist coffee mug.
Well, that's good. And even if I couldn't put my five penneth in at the time, I'd like to say congratulations, Doc. Well done for that. And hopefully we'll have another lucky winner this time next week as well.
And there you go. And you know what? We're moving into another topic at this point. And ladies and gentlemen, Tim and Kel might have a bit of an argument over this one. So just be prepared. We are now going to discuss rules for radicals. And it's a pragmatic primer for realistic radicals.
Oh, no,
radicals.
We're not. Yes. Sorry, I'm just playing.
You never know.
You never know.
It's the late work of tea organizer Saul D. Alinsky, and his last book was published in 1971, shortly before his death. His goal for the Rules for Radicals was to create a guide for future community organizers to use in uniting low-income communities or have-nots in order to empower them to gain social, political, and economic equality by challenging the current agencies that promote their inequality. Within it, Alinsky compiled the lessons he had learned throughout his personal experiences of community organizing spanning from 1939 to 1971, and targeted these lessons at the current new generation of radicals. Now, this book is divided into 10 chapters. Each chapter of Rules for Radicals provides a lesson on how a community organizer can accomplish the goal of successfully uniting people into an active organization with the power to effect change at a variety of issues through targeted via community organizations. These chapters also touch on a myriad of other issues that range from ethics, education, communication, and symbol construction to nonviolence and political philosophy. Okay, I have a problem right there already, Tim, but you tell me why you think this is A-OK.
Well, when this book was first written, the idea was that by changing the strategy of the opposition to somewhat, well, more than somewhat, that the political left would be able to gain power that they might not otherwise have been able to gain through the normal democratic channels. And so in that respect, it was considered quite revolutionary at the time. Now, you've got to remember when that was written, which was over 40 years ago, the political circumstances were quite different. You could argue that although there were changes from time to time between governments that were slightly left of centre and governments that were slightly right of centre, that was a largely superficial distinction. And all right, I'm sure there are going to be people who are going to take exception to what I say, because I am simplifying things for the sake of this program.
Simplifying things.
Let me just finish my point, okay? We had a very similar situation.
I'm teasing you. Go ahead.
Okay. We have a very similar situation over here in the United Kingdom, in that we have the illusion of a democratic system whereby, in theory, the will of the people determines the government that we have. But the three main parties that have held power over the past 60-odd years have been, I won't say in cahoots with each other, because, you know, that is oversimplifying it. But the policies that they've held have given the illusion that things change when they don't really, or they don't really change to a great extent. Now, what Saul Alinsky, he actually saw through this. And he proposed a system whereby, if it was implemented, would mean real revolutionary change, not blood on the streets type revolutionary change, as in the French Revolution or the Russian Revolution at the end of the First World War, but revolutionary change nonetheless. But he envisaged the old order being overturned and being replaced by a left wing order, which would in theory be much more fair to everybody. Now, as we previously discussed before the break, the only problem with all these liberal ideas is that when they're implemented, you end up with a system which is not what you intended, and in many ways is often worse than it would have been than if you'd left the system alone in the first place, which was why when I first started reading the book Rules for Radicals, I was somewhat suspicious that it would go against, it would be completely counter to some of the ideals that I hold. I was actually quite surprised, and the reason I was quite surprised was that the way in which these rules are expressed could actually be applied in a different way that Saul Alinsky intended. For example, we now have the situation, as we discussed before the break, where free speech is being criminalized and penalized in every Western democracy, especially in respect to Islam. And we have a situation where the powers that be, the authorities in pretty much every Western democracy, are doing whatever they can to stop to prevent the truth being heard by the electorate, so that they can apply an informed choice at the ballot box. People who dare to speak out, well, I won't say like myself, but there are people who have spoken out and have been severely punished in the past for having done so. And Paul Weston is just the latest example of somebody who's going to be charged or has been charged with racially aggravated crime purely for quoting the words of the great 20th century British politician Winston Churchill. So when I started reading this book, Rules for Radicals, I thought of it originally as being a book written for left-wingers who wanted to start a revolution. But the more I read it, the more I realized that there was an awful lot in there that could be applied to people who have been disenfranchised, like us, for example, who are rapidly becoming second-class citizens in our own country by being penalised for exercising our right to freedom of speech. There is actually quite a lot in there that you could look at and you could say could apply. Now, I'm not going to go too much further before I hand the mic back to Kel, but I would like to say this. When I was reading from quite a separate source, I came across a comment, a Chinese proverb that said, and please bear with me, ladies and gentlemen, this Chinese proverb said that the beginning of wisdom is calling things by their right names. And that rung a chord with me, because what we've got at the moment in our Western democracies is we are not allowed to call things by their right names. We are not allowed to say things like Islam is a totalitarian ideology rather than a religion, and as such it poses a great threat to the stability and long-term survival of our civilization. Now, I'm sure if I took a megaphone and stood on the steps of Birmingham Town Hall and expanded on that in my inimitable way, I might well suffer the same fate as Paul Weston, because the authorities do not want that message heard. They do not want that message out there. And when people like us try and disseminate that message, we're likely to be punished. And what's effectively happening is the authorities are calling things by different names. It's like it's the phenomenon of the emperor's new clothes. The policies that are being pursued by Western democracy, by various Western democracies, are completely bankrupt from an intellectual point of view. They are based on fantasy rather than reality, and as such, in the long term, they're doomed to failure. But in the short term, it forces us all to be very careful about what we say under threat of dire punishment. Now, calling things by their real names, if that's the first step towards the gaining of wisdom, I then looked at page 29 that I've got on this PDF of Rules for Radicals, and I'm just going to quickly copy and paste that. If somebody, I haven't looked at the chat room, somebody might already have done it, but here we go. Here we go. That's, oh, damn. Wrong. It's all right. Just bear with me. I'm still trying to work out how to do this copy and paste. You wouldn't believe I'm a computer consultant, ladies and gentlemen. You really wouldn't. I'm just going to see if I can find this. Damn it. That's what happens when you
No, ladies and gentlemen, he really is a rather esteemed computer consultant, and that he is headhunted. And you got a new keyboard this week, didn't you?
I did. Anyway, I'm gonna just quickly. Right, let's try this copy and paste once again, and then I'm going to go to page 29. I'm going to read something off page 29 for you. So here's the document, which anybody can download. It's a free PDF off the internet, and I'm now going to go to the document, if I can find it. Scroll down to page 29 and just read something out of it. Any second now. Any second now? Damn it.
Hurry.
God, I tell you, it's great being a professional broadcaster. Things flow so smoothly. I've nearly got it. Well, very nearly. Oh, God. shoot me now, somebody, please. Shoot me now.
Oh, you know what? I'm going...
Over to you, Kel. I'm going to find this document. I'm going to find this sooner later. I'm going to have you back.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Red Fox Blogger Comedy Central.
Oh, dear. Okay, I've got it. Right, now, quiet, I'm going to read this out. Okay. This is on...
Doc is asking in the chat room, is it happy hour somewhere?
Yeah, I think it must be. I'll tell you what, this mug of cocoa, I reckon, must have something in it. Anyway, on page 29...
I spiked it.
Rules for Radicals. I'm going to read verbatim from this document. The basic requirement for the understanding of the politics of change is to recognize the world as it is. We must work with it on its terms if we are to change it to the kind of world we would like it to be. We must first see the world as it is and not as we would like it to be. We must see the world as all political realists have, in terms of what men do and not what they ought to do, as Machiavelli and others have put it. And that's not too dissimilar from the Chinese proverb concerning the wisdom. And it was that similarity that struck me and made me think, well, what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. If left-wing strategists can use this to fundamentally alter the status quo back in the 1970s, there may be some principles in there that we could perhaps look at in our revolution that we want to implement to get rid of political correctness and multiculturalism and replace it with common sense, because that's going to require a revolution on its own. And what this book talks about is the mechanics of revolution. It's not talking about specifically implementing left-wing policies, although it does talk about that. It doesn't exclusively refer to it. And that's why I thought this book was particularly interesting, because we can discuss the mechanics of revolution and not just the implementation of left-wing policies. But now I've found page 29 and I've dropped the link in the chat room, I'm going to throw the mic back to you, Kel.
Well, I think these papers are rather dangerous, and I know that we have a very busy chat room, and that Vito Esposito in particular said that maybe we can use these rules to our own advantage, and I don't see why we couldn't in some aspects. But this, although I believe in grassroots, I do not believe in community organizers setting a state policy, and this is where Tim and I part ways. I do not believe in community organizers setting policy, whether it be in our House, our Senate, our parliamentary system. Tim, I'm sorry, but themes that persist throughout LST's lessons, and this it bothers me. The use of the common enemy against a community was done to promote another theme of rules for radicals, and they are calling for nonviolent conflict. Wait, okay, if you're going to write a paper like this, why would you even have to bring up the issue of nonviolent conflict? Now, this is something else. It just smells of anarchy to me. That's all, Tim.
Well, one of the things that was in play when Saul Alinsky wrote that book was he made the point that it's all very well calling for violent revolution and shouting slogans like power comes out of the barrel of a gun. If the other side have got all the guns, that's actually not a good way to go forward. And that's why he was thinking in terms of nonviolent revolution rather than doing what a lot of young people were doing back in the 1960s and early 1970s. They were actually calling for the violent overthrow of the status quo. And that, of course, upset a lot of people who had a vested interest in keeping things the way they were. We had some very nasty situations, particularly in the United States, where I think on one occasion, and I'm working from memory here, the National Guard were called out to, I think it might have been Kent University, actually ended up shooting some young people who were involved in a demonstration against the status quo, as I understand it. So, what his book or the Rules for Radicals was designed to do was to look for weaknesses in the current system and use those weaknesses to effect change. And I'm just looking at the parallels with today. As I've said on many occasions, I'm not in favour of violent revolution because, for one thing, blood on the streets is always bad and you get the law of unintended consequences creeping in and you might easily end up with a situation that was much worse than before you started. And so if you can affect change through non-violent means, I say that there is something to be said for it. Now, the exact ways in which that might be achieved, yes, we can certainly discuss about it. And I have to say, ladies and gentlemen, before we came on the show today, Kel and I did agree between us that we would take up opposite positions and argue from opposite positions, which is something we haven't done a great deal on these shows. So if it appears that we're at each other's throats by the end of the shows, then you know, please, no blood is normally spilt during these shows, so you won't
no
need
blood
to.
Is being spilled in the studio. But I do disagree with Tim in that I think that this book is rather dangerous in that it set a precedent in policy matters. You know, the scope and the influence of Rules for Radicals, for example, it's very far-reaching, Tim. And its compilation, it's just a tactic is what it is. That's how I see it. And if this is something very powerful that can be used by politicians, far left-leaning politicians, and this sort of mind-think is going to lead us back into Nazism, that's what I think, because it does have influences in that it will influence organizations in, within various communities and agency groups, in particular agency groups. That's the one that really bothers me. I don't think that this book should ever be referred to as any sort of influence guide by any politician, but it is. We are seeing that in the United States in particular. We're seeing that under the Obama administration. So papers like this or books like this, they should be outright banned. I'm sorry. Like, I believe in small government and I believe in grassroots movements, but this is not exactly what I envision for our movements in particular. When we are trying to goad our government into a set of policies that betters the greater good of the electorate and the populace, Rules for Radicals, I'm sorry, that one is not working for me.
Well, when you're trying to influence what the government does, the accepted way of doing things is to apply some sort of pressure, because if you can't apply any sort of pressure to the government, then the government will carry on doing whatever it has been doing, which might not be to the benefit of the country as a whole. It might be to the benefit of a few people in government itself. It might be to the benefit of a few favoured minorities. And I'm sure we can certainly think of some favoured minorities at the moment who are receiving government largesse on an unprecedented scale. And if we want to make changes to the way to what is happening there, so that these favoured minorities do not get undue preference to the detriment of the rest of us, we have to apply pressure in one form or another. Well, if one of the ways in which we apply pressure is through the means of free speech, and maybe by getting a hold of a megaphone and standing in a public place and saying what's on your mind and why you're not happy with certain things and what you would like to do to see change. And if the government then sends the forces of law and order to silence you, you have one less opportunity or one less avenue through which to make those changes happen. And if the government persists on shutting down all the what we would classify as legitimate routes for making change, because they're convinced that they're right and you're wrong and that's it, then what else is open to us? We need really to organise some form of pressure in one form or another. And it seems to me that there may be some lessons to be learned from this book. I understand that if you took it as a whole and applied it in the way that Saul Alinsky applied it back in 1970s, we might well end up with a government that is more dictatorial, more tyrannical, and more Nazi-like than we currently have. But I'm looking at some of the excerpts from this book, and I'm thinking there are maybe some lessons to be learned. And while I'm sure there'll be a lot of people out there who will agree with you that such publications are dangerous and that they ought to be banned, I think that if you've got the ability to discuss freely, and just have freedom of speech to talk about whatever you want, there should never be a need to ban a book. Bad books will die out of their own accord if people are allowed to talk about them. I mean, you just take, for example, the example of the Quran, okay? A more hateful, intolerant book, a manual for terrorism and insurrection, a more disgusting tome you could hardly envision. And yet we are being told that we're not allowed to discuss it in those terms, that because it is a so-called religious book, it is outside the realms of discussion. Well, I'm sorry, but that ain't gonna fly, not with me. I think if we had, there are some people who say the Quran ought to be banned. I say it ought to be discussed freely. There ought to be Quran discussion groups where you can freely and openly discuss everything about the Quran in the ways that we do here in the various counter-jihad shows that we co-host together and other shows that are on the internet and other forms of social media. We ought to be able to discuss it quite freely without fear of being bombed out of existence or attacked by groups of rabid Muslims intent on upholding the honour of their prophet. We should be able to say exactly what we want. And if the truth about Islam and the Quran were widely known through free speech and free discussion, Islam would crumble into dust. So I pass it back to you, Kel, and say I understand what you're saying about banning a book like Rules for Radicals because it's dangerous, but I think that taking away free speech and the ability to talk about these things is even more dangerous.
Well, you know, I just disagree with Saul Alinsky on principle anyway, and that this book has taken up so much traction within our political discourse, and that lest we forget that at least an over-the-shoulder acknowledgement to the very first radical from our legend, mythology, and history, the first radical known to man who rebelled against the establishment and did it so effectively that he at least won his own kingdom, and that comes from Lucifer. This is why I'm opposed to this book. But with that, we do have a caller here, Tim, and I'm going to bring him on right now. And this is Agador. Hello, Agador. How are you today?
I'm infinitely well, Kel. How are you? And how are you and Tim?
Oh, I'm unbelievably good.
Oh, we're feuding.
Well,
not really. No, we're not.
Well, fox and cat. You know, once in a while, you're gonna argue over the same bit of kill. So, you know, just take your favorite bits off, and you'll be fine.
Yeah, that's my mouse you got there, Kel. I'll have that if you don't mind.
Yeah, you're a very, very bad mouser there, Tim, I must say.
Well, I'm all right as long as I've got you to ship me the bits of mouse that you collect by Federal Express. That works for me.
There
so,
you go.
Yeah.
Well, I'll keep you fat and happy, you little brat.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that goes right back into the entire welfare state thing, which is beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, that's right, you know.
Come on, Tim.
To each according to his needs.
You're going to have to start pulling your weight there. You know, you can't just have Kel sending you mice. You know, I mean, once in a while, you're going to have to go out and get a bird for yourself.
You're absolutely right, Angel. You're absolutely right.
Of course, you know, it's got to be the right kind of bird because you don't want your wife getting jealous.
Well, quite. Truer than you know.
Agador, what do you think about Rules for Radicals, though? I'm totally opposed to publications like this.
All right. This is apropos of nothing, and you guys are going to have to forgive me, but you know, I put this in the chat room. I couldn't help it. I have had a cassette tape machine, which was specially built to play cassette tapes produced that had audiobooks on them. Okay, this was from the United States Library of Congress Talking Books program. All right, very tough cassette player. These things were built to be tough. You could drop these things off a 10-story building and it wouldn't hurt them. Mm. But one of the last books I got was Rules for Radicals. And I put the cassette of this thing in the machine, and it killed the machine. The machine actually just died. It would... It wouldn't work plugged into the wall. It wouldn't. Its batteries wouldn't take a charge, and they have long life batteries. It literally killed the poor machine. So, you know, that's the inherent evil in Rules for Radicals right there. It's a true story, I swear.
Well, you certainly made a very strong case. It's very difficult.
I would say Lucifer got in there, absolutely.
Well, I think so, but no. Okay. I'll get serious. I tend to agree with Tim in this, in that I don't think anything should be banned. You know, if they're bad ideas, you know, people are going to realize they're bad ideas soon enough and just walk away from them. I mean, okay, look at the Ku Klux Klan. You know, the only people who actually act like the Klan nowadays are Islamists. You know, and we see them using their techniques on Sonny's sister's house. You know, that was, you know, I mean, the only thing they didn't do was burn a crescent on their lawn. I mean, the bad ideas are going to out, and people are going to ignore them. And also, the other point about Rules for Radicals is I am not one of those people who says we can't do something because the other side does it. We have to look at what works and stick with our principles and do things based on that. If it happens to be a technique invented by someone we don't happen to like for some reason, oh, well. So be it. You know, if that technique's a good one that works and that gets us closer to our goal, there's no reason we can't use it as long as we hold on to our principles. Back to you.
Yeah, that actually ties in with something else we were talking about in a recent show, which is if we can reframe what we're doing in terms of fighting against Islam and say we're not so much against Islam, although we are against it, but we are fighting, reframing our argument as a civil rights fight. And if we can reposition ourselves in and take the moral high ground, even though it's using techniques which might once have been employed by the left, if it gets us closer to our goal, then I don't see any reason either that we can't actually use that technique, even though it's something we wouldn't normally have used because it's been traditionally associated with left-wing politics.
Well, I look at it. I look at this in almost military terms. I never served, but you know, I think it's a poor strategist that throws something away just because the enemy does it.
Kel, what do you think to Agador's argument there?
I'm sorry. I am not for censorship whatsoever. I am not. But there are certain publications that should be shelved. And believe me, if people want to go out of their way and find the publications, I think that they should be allowed to do so. But for this to be a free free-for-all in that people can just walk into a bookstore and pick them up or whatever, I think that it should be relegated to a PDF that people would have to go out of their way to seek, because what happens is that we end up with people like Adolf Hitler and Barack Hussein Obama. I'm sorry. Saul Alinsky, when he wrote the Rules for Radicals, he influenced senior politicians that we're seeing today. Hillary, back then, she was known as Hillary Rodham. She wrote her treatment on Saul Alinsky and Rules for Radicals. And look at that. She is the former Secretary of State. And now, you know, look at the mess that the United States is in because she was influenced by people like Saul Alinsky. This is the danger. This is the slippery slope. I disagree in that this should be absolutely accessible. No. If you want to do an academic research on Saul Alinsky, fine, go and do so. Hey, and while you're at it, hey, you know, knock yourselves out and go out there and read Mein Kampf by Adolf Hitler. Hey, let's have a party. Come on. And, hey, while we're at it, why not read books by the Ku Klux Klan. Hey, let's have a, you know, let's have a great old time. These are very dangerous publications, in my opinion, and I do think that they should not be outright banned, but they should absolutely be limited.
I don't know about you guys, but you know, I like Cooking with Pol Pot. I mean, that's a real page turner.
Cooking with Pol Pot. You'll have to excuse me, Agador, but I've not read that particular book. Are we talking about the same Pol Pot that made such a mess of Cambodia in the 1960s and 70s?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I couldn't resist that joke. I apologize to everyone.
Cooking with Pol Pot.
Agador,
you're going to burn in hell for that one.
Yeah, I am. Yeah. I'm sorry, Jesus.
Well, okay. I mean, you know, I think it's an argument that should be thrown open if anybody's got any other views on it. Agador and myself feel that it's far better to talk about bad ideas rather than to just outright ban them, and we shouldn't necessarily discard the strategy of our enemy if we can make use of it ourselves. And this is what I'm trying to suggest in the Rules for Radicals. While it might have been seen back in the 1970s as a completely radical and revolutionary set of ideas, and therefore, you know, dangerous to the people who were in authority at the time, we are now in a position where if we do not do something pretty radical and revolutionary ourselves, we are going to find that all the values, all the traditions and values that we hold dear are going to be snuffed out right under our noses, and our children and grandchildren are going to hate us for it because we did nothing when we could have done something. So I'm all for, I'm certainly all for saying that if you applied Saul Alinsky's ideas as a whole, you wouldn't necessarily come out with the kind of society that is good and is beneficial for everybody. No matter what your intentions might have been, if you implement every single idea in the way that Saul Alinsky wanted to implement it, I think you will end up with a totalitarian society that is no good for anybody, no good for humanity whatsoever. But there are some ideas that you could extract from that and that you could refine and apply them in today's circumstances in order to effect change, which we may not be able to do if the freedom of speech that we have enjoyed up to now is being slowly taken away from us.
Agador, please address that one. I have a lot to say about it, and Tim and I, we're going to probably go into quite an argument later on, but Agador, take that one away.
All right. Yeah, okay, yeah. Separate corners. I mean, the ability to speak, the ability to have the debate in the great arena of ideas, I think elevates all societies as long as all speech is tolerated. And when I say tolerated, I mean put up with. You know, I mean, for instance, I don't give any credence to what some, you know, idiotic race supremacist says. And note, I didn't say white supremacist because there are supremacists of other races. I don't give any credence to what they say. But that doesn't mean that I necessarily want to see them shut down or told to shut up or told that they can't speak. They can make idiots of themselves quite handily, and the rest of us can see them as such. It's often been said about the United States of America that the First Amendment is our most precious one, and I have to agree. Before anything else can be done, people have to know what's on the table and what's available and what's possible. And that can only be done through free and unfettered discussion in the public square. And I find it dangerous in the extreme when that is threatened by the use of any excuse, which which these days is the excuse of political correctness. This just happened to Paul Weston. There's a piece of legislation going through the House and Senate of the United States right now that's particularly nasty. You know, this is going on worldwide. So those are my thoughts on it. Kel, I will pass it back to you then.
Oh, thank you, Agador. And, you know, ladies and gentlemen, I am not for censorship, but there are certain things that I believe should be curtailed at the very least. I have made my points. I have made it quite clear about how I feel about Rules for Radicals and Saul Alinsky. When he wrote this book back in the 1960s, we had a real issue. Many years ago, my apologies. And when he wrote this book, we had people like Barack Hussein Obama just that ate it up, and Hillary Rodham back then. She's now Hillary Rodham Clinton. They ate this up, and it was devastating, especially in the United States of America, in that they used this as a guidebook to incorporate how they were going to run the United States. We are seeing politicians in Canada that are subscribing to the philosophy of Rules for Radicals, and we're seeing that with Justin Trudeau here in Canada. Yeah. We are seeing that in the UK. So this book is dangerous. I'm sorry, the ideology to me, it just screams danger. And look what has happened in the United States. It's going on, 7 years now that you've had to endure Barack Hussein Obama. And look what he has done to the country. And look what Hillary Rodham Clinton did. And believe me, I hope that Benghazi sees her imprisoned. But she was running along the philosophy of Rules for Radicals. And this sort of philosophy is... it's destroying countries. Tim?
Well, yes it is, in as much as the ideas that have been espoused there have been picked up and run with by the left, and people who should have been mounting an effective defence on the right of the political spectrum haven't been able to do so for probably a number of reasons. I don't say for a moment that there is one simple answer to why they haven't come up with the answer to this. But I mean, that's the thing about revolutionary ideas, is that if you are so used to thinking in a particular way, you may totally discount revolutionary ideas as either having no value or unlikely to be effective. And then before you know it, all the things that you hold dear have been taken away and swept from under your feet. And obviously, I'm going to have to oversimplify things by referring to the last 50 or 60 years in a couple of sentences, but it seems to me that the left have made great strides in promoting their political vision, and the right have struggled to come up with a good counter-argument in order to maintain their hold on political events. Now, you could argue that the Rules for Radicals has had a lot to do with that, and you'd probably be right. But I still don't think that's necessarily a reason for banning the publication or similar publications.
Well, no, I don't think it should be banned. I just think it should be limited reading. I'm not for banning Mein Kampf, for example, by Adolf Hitler. I think people that should be required reading in certain circumstances. All I'm saying is that this should not be in our public libraries. It certainly should not be in our universities. It should not be in our public schools. That's all I'm saying, is that it should be limited access.
Well, if you have limited access, what you then have to have by default is somebody who decides how that information is going to be limited. And if you have control over the allocation of knowledge. You thereby, by default, you give yourself political power in so doing. And that brings to mind the quotation from the Roman philosopher Juvenal, who memorably said, "Quis custodiet ipsos custodes," which is Latin for "who guards the guardians." And you're then into a philosophical discussion of to what extent do you allow limited access if you're not going to ban it altogether, but you're only going to allow a certain privileged class to have the opportunity of reading it. You're in danger of creating a society of privilege by default, and that might end up just as bad as what you're trying to prevent. I don't pretend to have all the answers here. What I'm doing is I'm posing questions, I suppose, by taking the position that I am on Rules for Radicals. As I say, we did agree between us before we started that we would present opposing arguments, and I think that's with something as divisive
absolutely.
As that.
Tim and I, we go over the show notes and everything together and decide what we're going to discuss every Monday at the Red Fox Blogger, and I suggested this, and Tim said, "Yeah, I'm all for that." I said, "Well, what angle do you want to take it?" And he said, "Well, I'm kind of for it," and I said, "Well, I'm against it." And okay, we're going to have a run at this, and Tim and I, we agree to disagree. And I have to say, though, that Tim is still the best co-host in the whole wide world. Please don't fire me, boss.
Well, likewise. But I think there's a serious argument there. Should we ban things like that, or should we not? And I'm sure that we haven't taken a straw poll in the chat room, but I'm sure there'll be one or two people
who
might
Tim.
Well say
you're
okay.
winning.
But yeah, I'm sure there are one or two people who will say that there is some knowledge that is so dangerous that it ought to be restricted. And it's certainly the case that if you haven't got the ability to think critically, then a little knowledge can be a dangerous thing. And here we go back to the analogy of Islam and Muslims and the Quran, because the Islamic ideology militates against critical thinking. What you have is a lot of Muslims who believe the absolute word of the Quran, won't have a word said against it, and have no intellectual structure to be able to deal with contrary points of view. They cannot do it. And if somebody presents them with a contrary point of view, such as people like us in Western societies, their immediate reaction is to fly into a rage because they don't have the intellectual capacity to be able to respond in a reasoned way. And then, under those circumstances, I certainly do agree that books like the Quran can be dangerous. Should they be banned? Well, if I had my way, I would certainly say that no Muslim should be allowed access to the Quran without, very, very careful course of psychological treatment in order to go with it.
Yeah.
That should be absolutely
mm-hmm.
compulsory. Would I say the Quran ought to be banned? Well, I don't think it would actually solve anything, because there are plenty of people out there who know the Quran off by heart, and if you ban a book just because it happens to be written down on paper, it will still be in men's minds. I still say that the way to deal with something like Islam is through free and open discussion, absolutely unfettered open discussion. People should be allowed to come along and say exactly what they like about the Quran anywhere and everywhere, and if Muslims cannot deal with that and they take offence, well, that is their problem. That is not our problem. At the moment, the political authorities in virtually every Western country are making it our problem, so it doesn't have to be the problem of Muslims. But that is not a situation which can last for very long. That's all I would say. And before I get into this too far, I'm going to hand the mic back to Kel, because I'm aware that we're running rapidly out of time on this show, so I'm going to turn the mic back to you, Kel.
Well, I think that this has been one fascinating last hour. I hope people enjoyed it. Tim and I had our first fight.
Hopefully,
but that's
not
okay,
the last.
You know, that's what it's all about. And that we can get together and agree to disagree. I have very strong viewpoints about this particular publication, and I want to thank Tim and Agador for ganging up on me. Oh, I mean, I want to thank Agador for calling in and contributing to the conversation.
You're always welcome, Kel.
There you go. We want to thank our friends, though, that joined us tonight. We really want to thank Agador, who joined us on the line. We want to thank Kath. We want to thank Doc, our winner. Doc, your mug is being packaged up, and it's going to be in the mail tomorrow for you. We want to thank Jeff of the English Defense League, our numerous guests that were here. We want to thank Has Questions, Luchadora, Paul Alexander, and Vito Esposito. It has been a banner show once again, and it's only possible because you guys take your time out of your otherwise busy day to spend with ours. We want to thank everybody that listens in archive, and please join Tim and myself tomorrow night, where we are part of the Radio Jihad Network, and we will be interviewing Erica Brazo, who is actually arrested for 15 months, suspended after 9, for what? Speaking the truth about Islam. So please, you'll want to be at the Freedom Loving Infidels tomorrow night at 6 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. And we always encourage you to listen to all the programs on the Radio Jihad Network. As a matter of fact, in 60... Oh, okay, Tim, you gave me that wonky watch again, didn't you? Okay, okay, I'll round it off. It's in an hour, Vito Esposito will be there at the Radio Jihad Network, and that is Mamma Mia, No Sharia. So, come on, there you go. I spit it out, Tim. But I really do want to thank everybody. So does Tim. And we're going to close it out, and I'm going to give Tim the final talking points.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Kel. Yeah, it has actually been most fascinating. And the argument moved on from the specific document, Rules for Radicals, into a general discussion of what should you do with information that can be dangerous in certain hands. That's an argument I'm sure we'll come back to again in the future show. But in the meantime, I'd like to thank everybody for joining us. I'd certainly like to offer my congratulations again to Doc for his achievement in acquiring one of the mendacious grievance-mongering tequila artist mugs. Mm-hmm. And there's only one left, ladies and gentlemen, so if you're going to enter our trivia quiz next week, remember you're going to have to fight for it. So
Who will be the winner
next week? So I hope you all enjoyed yourselves this evening. I'd like to say a very big thank you to Kel, the most wonderful co-host a red-blooded male could ever want. And thank you, Agador, for calling in and making this such a memorable show with us all.
You're welcome, Tim, and may I say, Rekel, giggity.
Oh, thanks, Agador. And on that note, ladies and gentlemen, we are going to bid you a very wonderful evening. And remember, though, it is mass Islamity, and we have to stop the insanity. Good night, Agador, and good night, Tim.
Yep. Good night, Agador. Good night, Kel. Good night, everybody.
Good night, Kel.
And
good night,
Tim. See you again soon. See you all again soon.
Keep hope alive.
I know sometimes in life you feel that everything is lost, and that mountain is just too high to climb.
Keep hope.
Well, that's when you gotta dig deep down inside and reach that inner strength you never knew you had. Give you the will to carry on another day. And all the day goes by and you're outside, still wondering why, watching everything you work so hard, and life all begins to fall apart. It breaks your heart to see it all crumbling at the wayside. You wanna lay your head down, pack it in and say goodbye, cause there's nothing left here to keep hope alive. Until you see the only two things in life that really matter. It's a little girl and a little boy. Once your foolish pride, once your beautiful joy. Even what's left of a candy bar when it's like the remains of a Chips Ahoy. Playing with a piece of driftwood that create a little mind made into a beautiful toy. And at that moment you realize you gotta rebuild everything Mother Nature had just destroyed. Their precious little heartbeats gave you the strength of a thousand men. Gave you the
way he sighs. Masterpiece, what a sheep's head.